So here we are as we approach Easter. Last week we spoke about Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane and that experience of pain and heartbreak and yet at the same time the way he was preparing himself for what was to come. And today we're going to be looking at the next part of this story, which is the arrest of Jesus. And even as I say that, you know, the arrest of Jesus, there's a question of like, well, how complicated could it be? You know, Jesus gets arrested. And yet there are forces, motivations, dynamics going on during this arrest that are quite profound and actually quite confusing. When you read the text at face value, when you kind of read through these verses as we will this morning, there are a few pieces in here that kind of go, why is that there? What is going on with Judas? Why is he having to identify Jesus? You know, look, what is actually going on there? I don't know if you've ever had an experience of being mistaken for somebody else. I can't ever say that anyone's ever mistaken me for a celebrity or anything like that, but I do remember one particular instance where it got me very confused because it was definitely a case of mistaken identity. Megan and I were invited to an amazing wedding. It was a Hindu wedding for some, I suppose, colleagues of Megan's. And we went to this lovely kind of, I suppose, hotel. That would be the word for it. Hotel in the city. It was in one of these grand function rooms where you'd walk in. And if you've ever been to a Hindu wedding, it's always huge. It's huge. It was glitzy. It was glamour. And it went for a really, really long time. And outside of, obviously, the ceremony that went for, you know, several hours, the thing that really caught my attention was the giant fondue chocolate fountain that was in, you know, the hallway. So the great thing was you were sitting around tables and then you could just keep going back. You know, you go out of the function room, you get more kind of chocolate fondue, you go back in and you just keep doing this, you know, for, you know, hours. And I was really enjoying this. You know, we all dressed up to the T. I was like in my best. So I was going out and out to get this fondue and I happened to notice, even though I was using the same plate over and over, which was of course getting that kind of chocolate kind of look over time, that the stack of plates, you know, that were available was slowly decreasing. Anyway, I went out to get some more chocolate fondue at one point and this lovely little lady came up to me, lovely little Indian lady who was, I don't know, part of the maybe the wider family or something like that. And she kind of tapped me on the shoulder and she said, "Oh, do you know if there's any more plates?" And I said to her, "Yeah, there are this," because I mean, I would have offered her mine, but obviously it's, you know, chocolate smeared. I'm like, "There's some just over there." And she kind of had this weird look at me. You know, you expect when you help someone, you expect them to be like, "Oh, thank you." But she was kind of like a little bit, almost like a little bit miffed. I'm like, "Okay, no worries. That's totally fine. I'll just get my fondue and go back in," right? I'm like, "That's okay." Anyway, so, you know, I eat all that and I go back in again And again, another little old lady comes up to me. She's like, "Hey, are there any more plates?" And I look over there and there's no more plates. And I'm like, "I'm really sorry. There's no more plates available. You know, I'd offer you mine, but obviously, you know, I can't." And she had this real look of disdain on her face. And I'm like, usually I'm really good with old people. I don't really know what's going on here. Why am I getting these like real adverse reactions? Maybe she just really wanted the fondue and she was like, you know, offended because she couldn't get it. And then as I walked back in, I suddenly looked around and it dawned on me. I had chosen to wear, you know, black pants, white shirt with a lovely black little waistcoat, you know, vest. And I looked around and suddenly realized that I was dressed like all of the other waitstaff. And while the majority of the people who were at the wedding were Indian, of course, I was Anglo, right? And so suddenly there was this sense of going, "Oh, no. These poor women, they thought that I was like the wait staff," and they're going, "Hey, are there any more plates?" I'm like, "No." Let alone the fact that I'm literally holding a plate covered in chocolate. Like, seriously, what do they think exactly is going on here with the wait staff? So I could understand the confusion. But it was definitely one of these cases of going, "Oh, you wanted me to be something, and I couldn't be that. Even if I tried to be that, I couldn't be that." And sometimes we can kind of find ourselves in this state where we really want someone to be something and maybe it's a misunderstanding about who they are or what their intentions are. But then when they don't deliver that, we end up really, really disappointed. We maybe end up with this kind of look of disdain, whether it be because they weren't who we thought they were or because maybe we're just confused. I want to posit that maybe in this story of the arrest that we're seeing today, there is a little bit of this going on. And maybe it's a take you might have not thought about before, but it is quite profound. You see, again, we often assume that we understand what's going on when it comes to Jesus' arrest and betrayal. But what if it's a bit more than just greed? What if it's actually a far more dangerous thread that runs through this story that we need to take attention to? Because it's important to acknowledge a few things. The story of Jesus' arrest appears in all four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So it is clearly a pivotal moment. Like, this is a very, very important moment that the Gospel writers do not want to miss. But every single Gospel includes slightly different details. In fact, some of them are quite profoundly different details, placing greater emphasis and lesser emphasis on different characters. And so if you actually put them all side by side, it's a fascinating lesson, right, on what the writer of the Gospels are trying to communicate to their audience, okay? It's really important because we're not trying to harmonize, we're not trying to put them all together and go, what actually happened? We're actually looking at the Gospel of Mark and saying, hey, what is Mark wanting to communicate to his Gospel audience? What is Mark wanting to communicate to us about the nature of Jesus' arrest at the time? So I just want to unpack this. We're going to start here in Mark 14:43. If you've got your Bible, feel free to turn to it as well. Just as Jesus was speaking, Judas, one of the 12, appeared. With him was a crowd armed with swords and clubs, sent from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. All right, so I just want to kind of highlight a few things, and if you're here for the first time, it's important to understand a bit of the backstory here. We've kind of got three key characters in this moment, so to speak. We've got Judas, who we'll talk about a little bit later. We've got this armed crowd, and we have this armed crowd that was sent from the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders. Now, a few things just to clear up here, because I've heard it way too many times, this idea that the crowd that cheered Jesus into Jerusalem was suddenly coming to arrest and crucify him. It's really important to understand this was a different crowd. This was a different crowd. And the reason we know that is because when Jesus was actually teaching in Jerusalem in this final week, the reason that the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders couldn't arrest him was because of the crowd. Like, if you actually look back in Mark, that's what it says. That's why they couldn't do it. So this particular crowd is a different crowd. It's one that is sent by the chief priests, and they are not the same people who welcomed Jesus into Jerusalem. The other thing to understand is that these chief priests, and we'll talk about this a bit more next week, aren't just some like religious leaders at the time. This is a very important group of people who had a lot of power. See, the chief priests existed in what was known as the Hasmonean dynasty. So I'm just going to flick back to this for those who love graphs. There were different expressions of first century Judaism. Now, the chief priests sat within what is over there known as the Sadducees. They are the people who had embraced Hellenism, that is, Greek and Roman ways of thinking, and were part of the priestly line. Now, at one point when essentially the priestly line had been kind of blown apart by a whole bunch of exile, they had to say, well, who is part of the priestly line still? And they had two particular families that they had to choose from. And the priestly line that emerged from those ashes was the priestly line known as Zadok. And the Zadokim in Hebrew translates as Sadducees into our English, okay? So the chief priests, by the time they were in power, were seven powerful families of the line of Zadokim, right, that essentially acted like a mafia at the time. So these aren't just like pious religious leaders who want, you know, all these good things. They had the booths of Annas. They were exploiting the people. These were power-hungry people who weren't ethical, and in fact, a lot of the people in this other side who had rejected Hellenism would say, you have sold your souls out to the Romans. You have sold your souls out to Hellenism and this way of thinking. So they were bad, bad guys, and we'll talk about how they expressed that next week. But it's important to understand that Jesus spent 3 years confronting the Pharisees, that's that bottom left-hand corner in the Hasidim. He spent 3 years confronting them. He was pointing out the gaps in their theology and their practice, and he survives for 3 years. But he spends 1 week in Jerusalem, and the chief priests take him out. Okay? This is the contrast that we need to understand when it comes to this story. So you've got the armed crowd sent by the corrupt chief priests, and of course, we have then Judas. It says in verse 44, now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him and lead him away under guard. Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, Rabbi, and kissed him. Now the gospel writers are going to go to great, great lengths to highlight that Judas was the betrayer. And I want to make something clear. He did betray Jesus. He did. But the reason the gospel writers have to make this very clear is because we actually have two stories of betrayal in this set, right? We're just about to have Peter, who is about to deny his rabbi, and you're going to have Judas, who hands over his rabbi to the crowd. Now, if you were to take out these references to the betrayer and feed these two stories to an Orthodox Jewish audience today, do you know who they would say betrayed Jesus? Peter. Out of those two stories, they would say Peter is the one who truly betrayed Jesus. And the reason is because there was no coming back from betraying your rabbi in their thought, right? There was no coming back from denying your rabbi. Whereas perhaps Judas, right, although he did something terrible, we don't actually know fully his motivations. In fact, the gospel writers don't provide his full motivations. In fact, to hand over your rabbi for 3 months' worth, maybe 4 months' worth of standard wages doesn't actually seem that compelling, even if he is described as greedy in other gospels. So what is actually going on here? What is going on in Mark's account of Judas and this moment of the arrest? This is what we do know. All the way up to this point, Jesus has been telling the disciples, I'm going to Jerusalem, I'm going to die, and then I'll be raised again. Three times. And the disciples over and over again have either remained silent, been afraid to ask any more questions, or actively resisted this by saying, no, this will never happen to you, which Jesus responds to Peter with, get behind me, Satan. Right? All I can say is at this point, the disciples clearly did not understand what was about to take place. Even from these previous weeks at the Last Supper, they're like, really? Someone's going to betray you? They're falling asleep in the Garden of Gethsemane, which again, Jesus says, your spirit is willing, but your body is weak. There is this disconnect between what they're expecting and the reality that is about to take place, even while Jesus has been so clear about what is going to happen. But on top of this, you've got to admit this last week for the disciples has been quite confusing. I mean, Jesus has rode in on a donkey and people are shouting, Hosanna. He's gone back into the temple and done this kind of wild kind of guerrilla theater, kind of, you know, taking out the whip and turning over the tables. Like it's quite hostile, you could say. It's active. It's certainly not passive and withdrawn. It's almost looking a little zealot-like. He's attacking the chief priests. He's attacking the teachers of the law. He's challenging the Pharisees. There is a level of kind of assertiveness that Jesus is expressing over this last week that seems very inconsistent in some ways with what has taken part in the past. And so I just wonder whether there is a little bit more going on in terms of what the disciples are expecting Jesus to do in this moment than what he actually does. You see, I'm convinced, and I'm happy to be challenged by this. This is one of many perspectives. You can say, yeah, Judas was just greedy. And you can say, yeah, Judas, you know, was invaded by an evil spirit, which is in one of the Gospels. You can have different scenarios, but Mark doesn't tell us what Judas's motivation is. But I'm convinced, with the setup in Mark, with all these teachings about power and about not becoming what Rome wants you to be, the disciples were still in this headspace that Jesus, the Messiah, was going to come and overthrow the system. And the reason I'm convinced of this is because whether it be prior to his death or even after his resurrection, they keep asking the same question. now is the time you're going to bring about the kingdom? Even after the resurrection, they're still going, so now are you going to bring about the kingdom? Now are you going to restore Israel? They've got this mindset, which we can be so susceptible to, which is like, he'll come and he'll change everything. And the truth is, we all want a Jesus that fits our expectations. How convenient is it for us to have a Jesus that fits our expectations? We all have this desire to craft God in our own image. I spoke last week about, you know, cold rock ice creamery God, where you choose the different pieces that you like and you reject the ones that you don't. And we tend to do this. It's like, I'll take this aspect of God for this particular moment because right now I need the God of justice. And right now I need the God of compassion. But we are so tempted to craft God in our image, and then we get frustrated when God is something beyond that. I mean, think of the story of Jonah. This is Jonah's problem, right? It's like, I knew you were a God of compassion. I knew you would save those Ninevites, and I'm not happy. Jonah wanted the kind of God that he could craft with his intentions, his agendas, his version of God. And so often we attempted to do this too, especially when God's ways are slower and more merciful and more subversive. And I suppose I want to bring this as a challenge because a lot of us don't reject Jesus outright. Instead, we tend to reshape him. It's kind of like a selective Jesus. We emphasize the parts we like and we reject the parts we don't. We might have politics that are shaping our version of Jesus. We know no one's immune from that. Maybe like last week, we're wanting Jesus to fix our problems rather than transforming us through the midst of them. And there's a big difference between following Jesus and then recruiting Jesus to our cause. We're all susceptible to this. Am I following Jesus, or am I trying to make Jesus follow me? And so you got these disciples who they go, it's Jesus, he's really stirring things up. I think this is the time. The Messiah has come. The kingdom will come. This is going to be the moment. And I just wonder whether Judas is thinking the same thing. In some ways, if we believe or we think or understand that disciples maybe weren't picturing the kind of Messiah that God had in mind, this kind of kiss moment makes far more sense. Because otherwise it feels somewhat unnecessary, feels somewhat intimate. I mean, yes, maybe this crowd didn't know who Jesus was. I suppose that's a possibility, but he'd been making waves. But I'm convinced that in this moment, Judas was trying to create a moment. He was trying to create a moment for something to happen. It was all building up to this point. Was Jesus going to be the one that he wanted Jesus to be? The one who would bring about the kingdom, the one who would overthrow the Romans using power that they knew that he had. I wonder if in this moment, Judas is essentially trying to kickstart the revolution. Because again, 30 pieces of silver, 3-4 months' wages, to hand over your rabbi, to then later in the story have as much guilt as he did, throwing the money back. I just feel like there's something more going on here. I mean, look at this. This is the Matthew account. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them. The one I kiss is the man, arrest him. Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and kissed him. And Jesus replied, "Do what you came for, friend." Isn't that a bizarre thing? Do what you came for, friend. Some translations say, why have you come, friend? Why have you come? What are you doing? What's your motivation here? And I love that in the midst of this confusion, mixed motivations, Jesus is still like, hey, friend. What are you doing? Or do what you've come for. I mean, Jesus has been journeying with this group for 3 years. None of this is a surprise for him. He's not like, oh, Judas. I can't help but feel this sense of like, man, Jesus, like, I just don't think you understand what's still going on. And we can't blame him because none of the disciples seem to understand what was going on. We look at these side by side and we ask the question, okay, the disciples want Jesus to be a certain type of Messiah. Maybe Judas is making this moment, forcing this moment, reflecting upon this last week and saying, okay, it's going to come to a head. Now, this is going to be the time when the kingdom breaks through. And Jesus says, hey, what are you doing? Will he comply with what he demands of him? Instead, we see in verse 46, the men seized Jesus and arrested him. The men stepped forward, seized Jesus and arrested him. You see, in this moment, Jesus doesn't become the person that Judas wants him to be. He doesn't become the person the disciples want him to be. He doesn't become the person that Peter said, this will never happen to you. He allows himself to be arrested. He's not going to buy into the, I'm going to bring about the kingdom through power and through force and through the methods of Rome and through the avenues of Caesar. I'm not going to be like the zealots who are going to bring about change through violence and revolution. Instead, he allows himself to be arrested. I mean, this is profound. Think about a first century audience who is reading this or hearing this gospel. They are being actively persecuted by Rome. They are being actively persecuted by the Caesars. And they have this moment that they are reading about how Jesus responds to this pivotal moment where he could change everything in the way that they want, but instead he chooses to be arrested. He chooses a different way. And it's important to understand this because in love, Jesus refuses to become the Messiah that we want him to be. You know, we would rather, at a deep kind of level, we would rather not love our enemy if we had the choice. You know, we would rather hold on tightly onto our assets rather than be generous. We would rather not forgive. But at the same time, Jesus doesn't allow himself to become that which we want him to be. He chooses a different way. I think about society in many respects. I know this is a bit of a challenging message, particularly for those of us who have held on to what was called Christendom for a long time. It was sometimes there's this sense in which it's like, if the Christians have the power, then we can bring about change. If we can have political power, then we can bring about the change that's needed. If we have social power, we can bring about the change that's needed. We can buy into this same kind of empire mentality where if we use the right strengths and the right power and the right influence, then we can produce the kingdom. And I'm not saying we don't have a responsibility to use that which is within our hands. But what we see here in this definitive moment registered in all four Gospels is Jesus not buying into the methods of Rome. Instead, he's saying, no, I'm willing to be arrested. I'm willing to die. I'm willing to sacrifice myself in love. Because that is where transformation is going to happen. Not through the methods of Rome, peace through power, but rather through sacrificial love. And that's important because as many people have pointed out, including Miroslav Volf and other theologians, when religion aligns with power, you end up with violence. That's what history teaches us. And so Jesus is demonstrating a different kind of way. But will we accept it? Will we accept this unique Jesus way? There's going to be resistance. There's going to be desire to use the methods of Rome. Then one of those standing near drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. Violence, control, power. This was a moment that was being created What, are we just going to roll over and allow Jesus to be arrested? This is not the path we want. No, no, we want the powerful, dominating Jesus. Now, in this gospel, it doesn't even talk about Jesus healing the servant, but in one other one that does. But Jesus says this, "Am I leading a rebellion?" Jesus said, "that you've come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I was with you, teaching in the temple courts, and you did not arrest me. But the scriptures must be fulfilled." This is why I'm convinced that this was Judas creating a moment. Because the thing that Jesus points out and the gospel writer points out is the response to this moment, the response to this arrest, the response to Jesus' unwillingness to be the kind of Messiah that Judas and the other disciples wanted him to be, was they responded with aggression, which is what they expected. And Jesus is like, "What are you doing, guys? What are you doing? You are employing the very thing that I'm nothing about." And he puts everything back in its place. Now, when it says here the scriptures must be fulfilled, it's actually hard to know what he's referring to, except that throughout the lead up to this story, he has referred to the book of Zechariah, which was a very popular book among the zealots, by the way. In Zechariah 13:7, it says, "Awake sword against my shepherd, against the man who is close to me, declares the Lord Almighty. Strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered, and I will turn my hand against the little ones." Now that might sound poetic and confusing, but this is actually the reference that Jesus makes just prior to this story. "You will all fall away," Jesus told his disciples, "for it is written, I will strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered." Jesus is saying this is about to take place, but notice who the sword is struck against. It's against the shepherd, the one who is close to God, not against the adversary, but against the shepherd. And the sheep would scatter, which is exactly what happened. Then everyone deserted and fled. Again, Judas would be so wrecked with guilt at the end of this story that he will take his own life. He's completely misread the situation. It's tragic. It's heartbreaking. Judas throws back the 30 silver pieces, which again is a reference to Zechariah chapter 11, where it talks about the 30 pieces that has been given for the shepherd. This whole story is about expectation and Jesus doing something different. The disciples didn't get it, and we sometimes don't get it either. And yet, when Jesus refused to be the Messiah we want, we have a choice. We're actually left with a choice. We can resist him. We can say, "That's not my kind of Jesus." Or keep using the methods of Rome and Caesar and empire. We can force Jesus into our agenda, reject his slow sacrificial kingdom, and then run away when he doesn't meet our expectations. Or we can take heed of this story and receive Jesus for who he actually is, a king who will ultimately win through sacrifice, the embrace of a kingdom that is built not through power but through love, and a Messiah who actually, through his own example, invites us to surrender. Or maybe Judas is just greedy. But there's something far more profound, I believe, going on here. And we need to heed it and hear it, particularly as recipients in this day and age where we can be so tempted to seek the power, even with good motives, to only discover that God has chosen a different way. Let me pray. Now, Jesus, we recognize that we hold in tension this balance between responsibility with what we have, but also your call and example of sacrifice. We sing those songs like, "Lead me to the cross, Lord." It's easy for those words to spring off our lips, and yet we recognize that in heeding to the way of the cross, your way, Jesus, involves sacrifice. Sometimes it means experiencing injustice. Sometimes it means patience rather than immediate results. And so often it means humility rather than arrogance and power and control. But God, you also knew that this had to take place. You know what you're working with. But God, where maybe in our hearts we have made a certain kind of idol of you, an idol that looks like our agendas, our motivations, the kind of Jesus we want, Lord, I want to pray that we would be challenged by this story. And it's by your Spirit you convict our hearts as to whether the picture of you that we have is accurate with how you have demonstrated your love. Would you approach us with that same question? Why are you here, friend? And then shake us up in your response. Thank you that you love us so much to meet us in the midst of our failures, our mistaken identities, our misguided agendas. And you lift us up. You make us new and continue to invite us to partner with you in your mission. Help us to do that faithfully, we pray in your name. Amen.